another week of the Dynamic Duo Show right here on GCNLive.com. I'm Kevin Barrett. I'm on Monday and Friday. Jim Fetzer's on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. Well, what's your favorite newspaper out of Washington, D.C.? Not the Washington Post, at least not for me. It's definitely not the Mooney Washington Times, even though they did break that Bush 1 administration child prostitution scandal. That was about the only good thing they've ever done. No. The best paper in Washington, D.C. is the Rock Creek Free Press. They've got the White House surrounded with their news boxes, and the Rock Creek Free Press is telling the truth in the heart of our nation's capital. Well, today on my show, I'm going to be bringing you a couple of people who have written extraordinary articles for the Rock Creek Free Press. In the second hour of the show, we'll bring on Ellen Brown. She is one of the latest and greatest of the people telling the truth about our monetary system. In her article, The Wall Street Meltdown, Fallout Hits Taxpayers, It's the Derivative, Stupid, is the lead screaming front page headline in the October edition of the Rock Creek Free Press. In the first hour, I'll be bringing you Barbara Honegger. She is another extraordinary person, and she published another extraordinary article in the Rock Creek Free Press recently on the links between anthrax and 9/11. That's actually the second great big screaming front page headline in the October edition of the Rock Creek Free Press. Barbara Honegger has a pretty interesting history. She's currently a senior journalist at the Naval Postgraduate Institute in Monterey, California. She's the author of October Surprise on Bush the Elder's treasonous deal to keep the hostages locked up until Reagan could beat Carter back in 1980. And she was the special assistant to the chief domestic policy advisor to the president in the Reagan administration. And in that position, she got some very interesting insights into the way the budget process works. She was close to Budget Director David Stockman, got to see what was going on there. And I'm sure she has some interesting ideas on the current financial crunch. And by the way, she is the author of the Pentagon Attack Papers, which is one of the most important analyses of what went on at the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001. So we should have plenty to talk about. Let's go ahead and give her some airtime. Welcome, Barbara Honegger. How are you, Barbara?
Hi, Kevin. It's great to be back on the program. Thanks so much.
Well, hey, it's always good to have you. I get a lot of good reviews when you're on, so let's keep up the good work here.
Well, good. Well, I'd really love to see those reviews. I always like positive feedback.
Well, I'll have to forward you some of those emails. I had a couple of very positive responses, I think, last time you were on.
Yeah. By the way, I would like to add to your little thumbnail sketch about my background that I was the, just so that people don't think that I'm one of them, I'm actually one of us. I was the first public resignation of conscience from the Reagan White House, from the Reagan administration, to 10 days of international publicity. So, I put everything, my entire career and actually my life on the line to tell the truth to the American public back in 1983 when I resigned in August. So I've been a whistleblower for decades.
Well, you know, the October surprise issue, which you took on, was a pretty dangerous issue at the time. It threatened to expose high treason.
It was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. And I had no idea that it was a genuine threat to the entire power structure of both Saudi Arabia and the Bush family links with Saudi Arabia when I did it. But that's maybe towards the end of the program we can talk about what October surprise McCain might be planning and Rove might be planning between now and November 4th and how we can defeat it. But we'll do that towards the end of the program because we want to talk about my experiences inside the White House on how the Reagan people, who are a seamless line in terms of the financial side of things and the monetary and financial side of things, how they actually planned this crisis that's just happening and why. So I don't know if you want to ask a particular question.
Sure. So you're saying they planned this crisis? We've heard that from a number of people who say that when Greenspan pumped up the housing bubble, that was done intentionally, knowing that it was going to deflate precipitously. And then, of course, the issue of the derivatives, the quadrillion-dollar derivatives bubble, which is obviously ridiculously unsustainable. We'll be talking with Ellen Brown about that in the second part of the program. What's your perspective on this financial crunch? How did they orchestrate it and why?
Well, it's not just my perspective. It's direct experience. I was actually in the Roosevelt room and in the cabinet room inside the West Wing of the White House when what I'm about to tell you happened. because I was the chief aide to the chief domestic policy advisor to President Reagan in the brand new first term of the Reagan administration, right after Inauguration Day, before he was the attempt on his life, before the assassination attempt by Hinckley against Reagan. So we're talking about sometime in February. Reagan wasn't shot until March. So sometime in February of 1981, right after the, shortly after the January 20th, 1981 inauguration, after Reagan defeated Carter, or I should say after the Reagan-Bush campaign stole the election from Carter, but that's the October surprise story, and we can do that later. But I was in this incredible position, basically the people's fly on the wall, and I made a moral decision to stay on the inside. Even though the policies of these people were abhorrent to me, I nevertheless made the decision to stay on the inside because I had worked at Stanford University for the man who happened to be tapped to be Reagan's chief domestic policy advisor. So, coattails phenomenon, I went with him, Martin Anderson, to the White House and ended up right over the Oval Office in the second floor of the West Wing. And so the event I'm about to tell you was phenomenally eye-opening to me. And you don't have to believe me. Anybody who really cares about this can contact me through you, and I still have the documents that David Stockman, who was the director of the Office of Management and Budget, and for Reagan in the White House in that first term, what happened in the Roosevelt Room of the White House, right opposite the hall of the Cabinet Room. It was an experience that I had with David Stockman making a presentation to President Reagan within a couple of weeks of his taking the presidency. And this is what happened. So rather than answer your question in the detailed specifics, was it the derivatives, was it the subprime, crisis, what was it in the detail level that actually was the final straw that triggered this, I'm going to give you the big picture that makes me know that they wanted this kind of crisis way back then. And this is what happened.
Okay.
Because I worked for Martin Anderson, I was actually the only female in the room, which is an interesting piece of history. There were all of these white males in the room. And
they're never going to invite any more females after you go out and blow the whistle on
them. Well, there's Condi Rice. You know, she's usually, if you've seen the movie W, she's the only female in the room there. They always have their token female, right?
Right. Well, she's one who I don't ever expect to see as a resignation of conscience. You have to have a conscience.
No, I don't think Condi Rice will know. That would be like George Bush resigning for conscience. That's not going to happen between now and January 20th of next year. But anyway, so here I was. I was the chief aide to the chief domestic policy advisor, and this was a meeting in February of 1981 in the West Wing of the White House in which the president, Ronald Reagan, the new president, was sitting at a very large conference table, and the people in the seats filling the conference table, besides myself and Dr. Anderson and the president, were the secretaries of all of the major departments, Secretary of Defense, head of the CIA, Secretary of Health and Human Services, Secretary of State, etc. And the purpose of the meeting was, after they had been in their various departments and agencies for the first 2 or 3 weeks, they were reporting back like you would in kindergarten, basically, to your teacher. Gee, Mr. President, this is what I've found that my department and agency really do, and here's the budget situation.
Okay, and what they reported to the president is going to have to wait until after the break.
All right.
So stay tuned. We're leaving you in suspense right here at the Dynamic Duo Show. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Living is easy with eyes closed. Understanding all you see. It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to strawberry fields. Nothing is real.
We're back. This is the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Barrett, and I'm speaking with Barbara Honegger, talking about when she was a special assistant to the chief domestic policy advisor to the president, Ronald Reagan. and a White House policy analyst. And Barbara, you were saying that shortly after getting into office, there was sort of a round table where people came to report to the president, and you can pick up the story from there.
Right. These were all of the cabinet secretaries to Reagan, from defense, state, human services, and the director of the Office of Management and Budget, who was then the famous David Stockman. And so when it got to David Stockman's time to make his five-minute presentation about what he had discovered with the state of the federal budget in the first 2 to 3 weeks of the first Reagan administration, this is before Reagan, the assassination attempt on Reagan's life, he made the following presentation, and it was very interesting. Reagan was sitting in the middle of one side of this long conference table, and he looked like he was asleep. He had his head down, which often happened in cabinet meetings. He wasn't snoring, but he had his eyes closed, but he was listening very intently. I knew this. Many people would have thought he wasn't paying attention, but it was just the opposite. So David Stockman has an easel, and he puts up these big charts, these flip charts, and I kept those flip charts. So I have the proof of what I'm about to tell you. I have them at my home in California. And what David Stockman told all of his cabinet members, as well as the president, Reagan, and interestingly, Vice President Bush was not present, just Reagan. He said, you know, Mr. President, he was very worried. This is David Stockman, director of the Office of Management and Budget. He said, Mr. President, I'm very worried. He said, I've been crunching numbers past midnight for the past 3 weeks, and I have put in these charts to show you what I've discovered. He said, Mr. President, when you were running for president before you won the election in last November, when you were running for president, you promised the American people that you were going to massively reduce taxes, that is, reduce the income to the federal government. You were going to massively increase defense spending to fight the, you know, so-called evil empire. We were still during the Cold War then. You were going to, these two together, I've crunched the numbers, and I want to show you, Mr. President, that if you massively reduce the income taxes to the government and massively increase defense spending, and there are laws that don't let you decrease Social Security, you know, that it's locked in there, here's a chart that shows that by the end of your term as president, the federal government is going to be $5 trillion in debt. You are going to bankrupt the federal government, Mr. President. This is an emergency. You have to change your policy. You have to change your economic policy. And everyone, all eyes turned to the president, who still had his head down with his eyes closed. He snapped his head up. He opened his eyes. He glowered. He glared at David Stockman. And he said, Mr. Stockman, I don't think you understand. President Reagan said, like a general in an army, he said, I don't think you understand. He said, that is our purpose. That is our goal, to bankrupt the entire domestic side of the U.S. federal government. When we are done, all there will be is the military, the police, and the courts. It is a libertarian agenda. Mr. Stockman, you do not understand. It was shortly after that that David Stockman resigned. That was the real reason over which he resigned. He was shocked to hear this from the President of the United States.
Now, what did he say was the reason? I recall that resignation vaguely. What was his public reason?
You know, I forget, frankly, but I read his book at the time. He wrote a book, something like There at the Revolution. Anyway, just look up David Stockman's book that was published in the early 80s. And I read his book at the time, and he doesn't give the real reason. Many times people don't give the real reason. But it was considered a kiss-and-tell book. After he resigned, he really knocked the Reagan administration, very much like the Secretary of the Treasury knocked the current Bush administration when he resigned early on. So the bottom line is, and by the way, I should back up a little bit. The reason I was at the White House in the first place was that I was at Stanford University prior to that, and in order to simply earn money to put myself through graduate school in neuropsychology, I needed a job. So I worked half-time, and I went to school half-time. And the job that I had, I was hired at the Hoover Institution, not knowing anything about it. I was completely apolitical at the time. But it was a job. It was income. And I was hired as a research associate for a man by the name of Dr. Martin Anderson, who is still there. He went back. and he's still there as a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Very powerful person in the Republican Party and, in fact, the current administration. He's been a member of Donald Rumsfeld's Defense Policy Board for ages, the people who, you know, were under Richard Perle, if you can imagine, the kind of ultimate neocon.
Gee, you know, Barbara, it sounds like you hang out with the wrong crowd.
No, actually, I'm hanging out with you, Kevin, in the right crowd. But I was there, as I'm trying to explain to people so they understand who I am. I was there because I simply signed up, you know, answered an ad in the paper for a job, happened to be the Hoover Institution, didn't know anything about it, and I did such a great job helping Martin Anderson write his books, some of which I'm co-author on, while I was putting myself through graduate school in the late 70s and early 80s, that when Martin Anderson was tapped to be Reagan's chief domestic policy advisor, I went with him because I worked for Martin, not for Reagan. And so I was there, and I should tell you that down the hall about three doors from my office at the Hoover Institution, before Marty was tapped to go to the White House and took me with him in 1981, early 81, was a man by the name of Milton Friedman. And if you have recently, I don't know if you've read The Shock Doctrine.
Yes, I have.
By Naomi Klein.
Yes, that's a very, very important book.
In The Shock Doctrine, Naomi Klein was recently, just last weekend, here in Santa Cruz. I went with friends from our local Monterey, California 9/11 Truth Group to hear her. And a big part of her presentation is that Milton Friedman was the mastermind behind the Reagan, so-called Reaganomics. Well, he was three doors down the hall from my boss and myself, Martin Anderson, at the Hoover Institution. And I can tell you that Martin Anderson worked with Milton Friedman to come up with this design to intentionally bankrupt the domestic side of the federal government.
Well, that's one way to shock the country, isn't it? $5 trillion debt is
exactly.
A pretty big slap in the face.
Exactly. Now, what they counted on, though, they actually counted on the Cold War continuing. They counted on the B team, which was under George Bush Sr., as you know, when he was head of the CIA and after. The B team at the CIA ratcheted up and increased the perception of the threat of the Soviet Union. And they needed that in order to increase defense spending and have their excuse that they needed to massively increase defense spending under Reagan. So
the real purpose wasn't to defend ourselves against the evil empire. It was to bankrupt the country and create a shock in order to transform the system and eliminate
In order to transform government. The domestic side of the federal government
wow.
and squeeze it out of existence.
To the Dynamic Duo Show right here on GCNLive.com. I'm Kevin Barrett, and I'm talking with Barbara Honegger during the first hour. Ellen Brown comes on the second hour. They're the top two stories in the October edition of the Rock Creek Free Press, possibly our best national newspaper out of Washington, D.C. And so, Barbara, you're saying that the shock doctrine was in operation from the beginning of the Reagan administration, that Reagan intentionally bankrupted the country in order to deliver a powerful shock that would allow them to remove most of the federal government programs other than police, military, and prisons.
Well, it didn't happen under Reagan, but it started under Reagan. It was a conscious plan to bankrupt the entire federal domestic side of the federal government, leaving only the military, police, and the courts. And by the way, their intent is to eliminate all of Social Security. That's why you hear the Republicans talk about privatizing it. But there's a really fundamental point I want to get across as to why this would work. Remember I said that they counted on there being a huge enemy, in that case, the so-called evil empire of the Soviet Union. Well, it was a big shock to them when the Soviet Union suddenly fell. And in fact, if you recall, Gorbachev said to Reagan or Margaret Thatcher or somebody. Anyway, it's a famous quote. He said, you know, we're going to do something that will ruin your plans. We're going to eliminate ourselves. We're going to remove your enemy. And what that did was is that started, that eliminated the pretext and the excuse for a massive defense budget. So they needed a new enemy, and that's the real reason for 9/11. They needed this so-called perpetual eternal war on terror with this amorphous enemy. You don't really know who it is. It's everywhere. It's nowhere. This is the perfect new enemy in order to justify massive defense spending. So, but there's another fundamental point, and that is the mechanism by which the Republican plan to bankrupt the entire domestic side of the federal government. This was the mechanism. They are against taxes. They say they were going to massively reduce taxes, and in fact, David Stockman did that before he left, before he resigned. So the Republicans say, oh, those Democrats, they want to tax and spend, they want to tax and spend. But the truth is the Republicans borrow and spend. And it was their intent to massively increase, the more you increase the deficit, the more you have to borrow to cover the deficit or tax, but they're against taxation. So they massively borrow, and now we're in this massive borrowing crisis where effectively the total amount that the U.S. government, the American people, owe through their federal government is the equivalent to the entire gross domestic product of the United States for a year. And, if you go to a bank, Kevin, and you say, will you lend me money, and you've already borrowed as much as you make in a year, that's usually that's kind of a psychological cutoff point. It's not surprising that there is this massive budget crisis in the world, because the American public, through its government, now owes an entire year of its gross domestic product. But just think about it. Because the Republicans hold taxes down, massively increase defense spending, they want to privatize the Social Security and ultimately eliminate the whole domestic side. What is the mechanism by which they're going to squeeze out that domestic side? They need a perpetual enemy, that's the so-called war on terror, okay, in order to justify keeping the defense budget going up. But how do they squeeze out the domestic sector? They do that by intentionally increasing the debt and therefore increasing the amount of the federal budget pie that goes to interest payments until that interest payment portion squeezes out the entire domestic portion of the federal government. That was a conscious plan of Ronald Reagan, of Milton Friedman, and David Stockman when he was told by Reagan explicitly in February in 1981 in the meeting where I was present, and I've kept his charts. I have them at my home in California to prove it. He was shocked, and that was the real reason for his resignation. They have a conscious plan.
Well, this is pretty.
They now substituted the war on terror.
This is very shocking. To Wisconsin people. I'm running for Congress here in Wisconsin at BarrettForCongress.us, and a lot of ordinary people here in Wisconsin have this impression left over from many decades ago that the Republicans are the party of fiscal responsibility. They're the people
who don't
spend more than they take in, and it's quite the opposite, isn't it?
It's quite the opposite. They're in fact, just use these words. The Republicans borrow and spend, they borrow and spend into massive deficits, and they have therefore caused the crisis. They have intentionally and easily caused the crisis that we are in today, and they desired it, and Ronald Reagan said so, and he told his director of management and budget so in February of 1981 in the Roosevelt Room of the White House. That's an extremely important message for people to understand. And by the way, this is not the first time I've gone public with this. When I resigned from the Reagan administration, I went all over the country. I even went to was either Dallas or Houston, where in Texas, where the Republicans held their 1984 Republican National Convention, where they renominated Reagan. I went there. I held on my own nickel. I held a press conference that was massively attended by the national press that followed everybody to the Republican National Convention. And I took my charts with me, and it was published in the Houston paper. So I've gone public with this many times, but today it's more important than ever because their plan is coming into fruition. And I'm here to warn everyone who's listening. Not that your listeners are likely to vote for McCain anyway, but when you hear McCain saying, well, we can't tax, the Democrats are going to tax, McCain will continue to borrow as much as he can, and McCain is already saying, well, if I get in there, we're going to massively eliminate programs. He's not going to eliminate any defense programs, I guarantee you. It's going to continue the Reagan and the Milton Friedman plan that Naomi Klein talks about in the Shock Doctrine.
Well, I'm convinced, Barbara. I mean, even if you hadn't told me this, I would pretty much have figured out this big picture anyway. Question would be, though, so let's say we elect Obama. Is Obama's real role, is he going to reverse this, or is he actually going to, you know, kind of do what Carter did, preside over a period of stagflation, get blamed for it, and
You know, I'm not an economist, and by the way, I really hope that your guest in the next hour, I'm not going to be able to listen to that program, but I will listen to it on archives, you know, later tonight or tomorrow. But do encourage her, in fact, urge her, if she's not already listened to this hour of the program, to listen to it on your website. Because it's very important for her to hear what I'm saying. What I believe that Obama will do if he's smart, although I'm not an economist, she is, but I do have this direct experience. And I believe that if he's smart, he will do Keynesian economics. He will simply spend. The federal government will simply create programs like we did, you know, after the Great Depression. If he's smart, he will get the money in circulation and use the federal government to do it. And he will be forced to either tax or borrow or some combination of the two. But the most important thing is to get the money circulating.
Okay. Well, you know, there is a consensus, though, it seems to me, at the highest levels of the Democratic and Republican parties, which is driven by the financiers who are behind both parties, that we're going to continue down this military Keynesian path. That is, the you know, military spending will drive the economy. And Obama doesn't really seem to have differed with that very much. He's calling for more military spending.
No, in fact, I'll tell you. My gut tells me that what Obama is saying in order to get elected is not necessarily what he will do once he's in office. And I mean that in a positive sense. It does concern me that, as you know, Obama has said, well, we need more troops. We need to put our emphasis on Afghanistan. And in order to do that, he has to buy the official lie of 9/11. He has to lie that Al-Qaeda did 9/11. And so that concerns me. I doubt that Obama will do anything serious or allow anything serious or put his imprimatur on anything serious by the federal government to reopen the 9/11 investigation, because he needs the official lie of the official story of 9/11 to justify increasing troops in Afghanistan.
And that sounds like a good reason to vote for a third-party candidate, but maybe, Barbara, you'll give us some reasons to stick with Obama if you want when we come back. This is Kevin Barrett on Dynamic Duo, talking with Barbara Honegger. You can find out about her at patriotquestion911.com.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
Welcome back to the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Barrett, talking with Barbara Honegger this hour, bringing on Ellen Brown next hour to talk about the financial crisis. And Barbara, you were saying that the Republicans are clearly engineering the collapse of the domestic side of the government, and indeed the collapse of the economy, and they're trying to rake in all the chips for the, you know, billionaire financiers. So if the Republicans are doing that, does that mean that the Democrats are in any sense the good guys here? And as you were saying, if Obama is actually planning to increase the military budget and go after Pakistan, and as Tarpley says, maybe China and Russia, is he really worth voting for?
Well, first off, I don't buy Webster Tarpley's BS about that. In fact, I love Webster Tarpley as a person, and until he came out with this, as far as I'm concerned, Webster has lost his rationality about this particular election campaign. He obviously has a great animosity, Webster does, for Brzezinski, and I understand that. But Brzezinski is just one advisor to Obama, and Obama is not Brzezinski. I mean, look, there are only two candidates who are going to be in the White House, one of two candidates. One of them is Obama, and one of them is McCain. I've just explained to you how if you vote for McCain, and I doubt that most of your listeners would, But if anybody is considering voting for McCain, that is giving this plan, believe me, the plan will be enacted. They need a Republican in this next election in order to use the financial crisis to intentionally squeeze out the domestic side of the federal government, privatize everything, and then once you privatize it, of course, you continue to have the financial crisis and everybody loses their health care once it's been privatized anyway. You need to keep Social Security.
So wait a minute, Barbara. Reaganomics says that our doing this, bankrupting the country, will somehow cause a tremendous explosion of economic growth that will trickle down and everybody will get rich.
No, that's just their propaganda. Their actual plan is to destroy the domestic side of the federal government, squeeze it out, as I said, by massively increasing borrowing, reducing taxes, that is, reducing the income to the government, massively increasing borrowing, and using the increasing interest on the massively increased debt from the massively increased borrowing to squeeze out the domestic side. But in order for that to succeed, they have to have a credible global threat. And they lost the evil empire threat when the Soviet Union crumbled. That was Gorbachev's plan to reduce that enemy and destroy the pretext for the U.S. Defense Department spending. And so they needed 9/11, which, of course, the official story of that is a lie, as we know, in order to create this new evil world evil empire in order to justify the continued increased defense spending. So that if for any reason, that's why the truth about 9/11 is absolutely critical to destroying this evil plan of theirs, Kevin.
Well, I agree with you there completely, 100%.
The critical mass of people understand that the Bush administration was complicit in 9/11 itself. They basically did the attacks and killed some 3,000 innocent civilians. Once they realize that, that's the equivalent of the Boston, the Boston massacre, and everything crumbles. I mean, their plan will crumble just like the World Trade Center fell in about 9/11.
That's what we're working on, Barbara. But, you know, some people worry that the Obama campaign has actually helped kind of defuse the 9/11 truth movement by taking all these people who should be coming over to our side and being thoroughly disillusioned and angry and ready for genuine change and having them plug into this mythical change that's being phrased in vague terms. And, you know, if Obama does get in there and the financial crisis gets worse and he can't really do anything, then,
yes,
you know, where are we going to be?
Of course, no, he can't. You bought the perspective of the Republicans instead of non-Republicans. I mean, the Constitution says that only the Congress can create money. The bottom line is that if there is serious change, the most important thing is that money continues to circulate. You can either tax to get it, you can borrow to get it, or you can create it. And if you create it, that actually favors the borrowers and harms those who lend, the bankers.
Absolutely. I agree 100%.
Are for the bankers.
And the Federal Reserve starting to lend money directly from the Treasury, start coining actual U.S. currency for once.
Exactly. You have to do it slowly but surely and gradually. But look, the bottom line is only one of those two men, McCain and Obama, is going to be elected. I've showed you why you can't vote for McCain. That leaves Obama. A vote for anyone else is a vote. If you don't want to vote for McCain and you don't vote for Obama and vote for someone else, you might as well have cast your vote for McCain. I'm voting for Obama. He's not the best candidate, but he is definitely the better of the two candidates.
This sounds like a lesser evil argument. Jesse Ventura always points out that voting for the lesser evil is still voting for evil.
No, it isn't. No, not in this case. It is true that the Democrats have been effectively the enablers of the evil Republicans, but they are not evil in and of themselves, and they have not had their veto proof, their cloture proof, 61 members of the Senate, and they need that, and I hope to God that they get it.
Okay, well, you've given us a perspective that's diametrically opposed to what Webster came out and gave last week, and that's what we're here for at the Dynamic Duo, is to get all the perspectives
out there.
That's
right, and by the way, I think Webster knows better. I don't know why he's doing what he's doing, but he knows that Brzezinski is not Obama, that Brzezinski is just one advisor. He hates Brzezinski, I can understand that, but Brzezinski is not running for president.
Well, I think he's also concerned, as I am, and a lot of people are, Eric Larson, for example, we're concerned about the way the Obama campaign has really avoided talking about issues and has created this sort of almost mass hypnosis effect with, you know, really captivating vague speeches with these ethereal words and, you know, kind of, it doesn't seem to be fostering critical political dialogue. It seems to be fostering a kind of a trance or something.
I don't agree with you. I mean, if you go to Obama's website, I mean, he's not my ideal candidate, but I'm certainly going to vote for him because I'm not going to vote for the Republicans to put in place their plan that I was at the meeting in 1981 and know what it is. It's an evil plan. So I'm going to block that plan, whatever it takes.
Well, I agree with you.
But if you actually go to Obama's website, his policies are very explicit. But he's a poet. You know, he's a great orator and he's a poet. I don't expect there to be a lot of detail in speeches. That's why they work.
Well, okay, you're making a good case. You know, I totally agree with you. The Republicans are clearly more centered around evil at this point in history than the Democrats are. There's no question about that. You know, anywhere, any perspective you look at it from, there's a higher ratio of evil to non-evil in the Republican Party than in the Democratic Party. But
don't forget those anthrax letters, and we haven't been able to get into it today, but I will take 1 second to tell you the new breakthrough in the anthrax 9/11 link.
Oh, yeah, do that quickly. We only have a minute left.
The anthrax letters, don't forget, those anthrax letters went to the Democratic leaders in the Senate. It was basically a Reichstag fire-type attack on the Democratic leadership of the Senate. It clearly was to the benefit of the Republicans. It pushed through the Patriot Act, you know, in the dead of night without anybody being able to read it. It was basically those anthrax letters were a cock-loaded gun at the head of the Democratic leadership of the Congress. Anybody who has any brain knows that the Democrats these past, well, now 7 years, have had a locked, loaded gun to their head. And you shouldn't blame them too much for that. They need to get in power to put in the proper policies.
Well, frankly, when somebody points that gun at my head, my tendency is to try to quickly find a way to disarm them, you know, just going along with them like this. And the Democrats didn't have to go along with them nearly to the point that they have. You know, my own opponent, Ron Kind, here.
And Nancy Pelosi certainly didn't need to take impeachment off the table before the 2000 election, not after. No, of course they didn't. But they did. That's the history behind it. What we're looking, look, this election is about what is the better choice on November 4th? What is the better choice? And the way I like to look at elections is this, Kevin, and I hope that your listeners really take this to heart. I don't know if you wear glasses. I've worn glasses since I was 5 or 6 years old. You go into the optometrist's office, and in order to find your prescription that makes you see perfectly at the end, they give you only binary choices. Is this better or is this? Is right better or is left? And sometimes you say right, sometimes you say left. This time, the left is better. The left is phenomenally better. If you choose McCain, that's the right, you are choosing a very blurry, very evil picture compared to the alternative choice. And it's only a binary choice. But at the end of each election, it's like that. Is it left better or right better? And at the end, the optometrist is able to calculate the perfect prescription and you see clearly. We're not going to see clearly as a political system after each election, but at the end of the process, if we in fact use our consciences and use our judgment and not, like Webster, become irrational, and you actually make a rational choice in the voting booth, then we will come out okay at the end.
Okay, well, I guess time will tell, but thank you for putting forth that argument. Thank you for all the great work that you've done on some of the key issues of our time, Barbara. It's always an honor to have you on.
And be sure and have Ellen listen to this program.
Okay, I'll pass that on to her.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye, Barbara.
Yep.